Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And I hope everybody had a great Christmas. I hope it was Christ-centered, as it should be. And I hope we took an opportunity to kind of reflect on, you know, how is it that we're really celebrating Christmas? Are we celebrating it in such a materialistic manner? And how can we actually do it? I mean, I guess the one thing that I didn't get a chance, there's a couple things. Let me do a go back. Next year, and ponder upon this all year, how would Christ want us to recognize and celebrate Christmas? If we were going to take aside one day to celebrate his birth, then how would he want us to do that? Would he want us to basically, you know, go into debt on trying to buy gifts for people? Or would he want... Because, folks, I know, I've seen this. I've seen people actually go into the red because they just feel compelled that they, as a matter of fact, I personally know people that have this unbelievable burden that they need to spend money on Christmas. And there's way too many people that have their whole life centered on what gifts they get. Folks, let's back out a little bit. Let's really think about what this should be doing, even though this is not the time of year of his birth. But since we've decided as a culture to come together for this one point in time, you know, those stories, those things that we've heard, you know, about people crossing boundaries and actually giving comfort and aid and succor to those who are in need. Those are the things I think, you know, the compassion, the overwhelming, overflowing of our bowels for those who need help and compassion. And so one of the things that I would also want to point out, and I didn't get a chance to mention this, when we look at religious times, especially within, I'll just say, Judeo-Christian, and I think world religions, period, they come up with poems, they come up with songs, hymns, or what have you, to, you know, center themselves on. And so I ask any of you to please do the due diligence and look at when these songs regarding Christmas time were written, because you'll notice that all of a sudden it was in the 1800s that Christmas songs were written. This actually goes to help support and substantiate. It was late in the 1800s, and a lot of things, just because the fever of Christmas in the early 1900s, it became so much more magical because people kind of lived and they really went out. They really sacrificed. And I'm going, well, you know, folks, we need to start recognizing that maybe we got caught up because we were programmed to, or maybe we were influenced to become so caught up. And let's just say that corporations have been able to really get across their, you know, I'll just say their hurdles in, you know, making their sales and staying in the black. Let's change that. Let's make companies actually live and produce and work within their means. And let's all of us live, produce, and work within our means and share with each other those things that are actually centered on Christ instead of those things centered on this world. Anyway, one of the things I was asked to do is, you know, as a kind of a summation, I need to kind of look at the Constitution and this constitutional framework. In my article on why counties matter most, I have to build the case, and it's not that hard. When we look at what it took, okay, so we had 13 states that rebelled and actually revolted against the Crown of Britain. And when we rebelled, we chose to go down a different path. Now, we created a Republican form of government, but we weren't done yet. And as a matter of fact, when we created a Republican form of government, we still maintained some of the governing processes and the form of government. In other words, we didn't really abandon in the Articles of Association and Articles of Confederation, we didn't really abandon the doctrine of magistrates. Now, you probably heard me either on the show or in other points in time talk about the doctrine of magistrates and the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. Those doctrines were abandoned when we created the Constitution. We literally said we are a representative government. We do not have magistrates anymore. And what we did was we severed the omnipotent magistrate into three separate functions. We created the legislative, which was our most powerful portion of the magistrate, to make laws and to, take away laws, the ability to oppress. The executive was the part of the enforcement. So the executive doesn't have, as a matter of fact, I want to be clear here. The executive does not have the ability to make law. The only ability they have over law is a negative power. In other words, they have the veto power. So when we see presidents exert power by legislating with executive orders like Biden has been doing, that is a direct violation of the Constitution. He cannot create law. He cannot go down these paths and do what he's been doing. Ah, but many presidents have been doing this and they've been getting away with this. But bottom line, when you really look at the Constitution, the only power is a negative power upon law. He can say, we're not doing this. This is why I kind of pointed out in the very beginning, the president does have the power to shut down the execution of unconstitutional law, not add upon it, not to take it even one step further and become even more tyrannical. So even the governors, the way we set up our government system from the federal, state, and county, the executive possesses negative powers when they feel that the legislature has gone too far. Now, I can show you in the state of Washington, the dolt Inslee, he's such a narcissist. But anyway, Inslee has been taking upon himself all of these presumptions or is assuming powers and trying to shut down the hydroelectric dam system that Washington has and injecting facial recognition technology. There's all sorts of things that he's been working with the progressive legislature in moving an agenda forward, in locking tyranny upon the citizens of Washington. He's not the only one. This is happening in New York. This is happening throughout our union. Our governors do not have positive law. They have negative law. And this is what we need to start looking in the measure of the man that or woman that we want to serve in that capacity. We want to make sure that they understand that they have negative powers, that they keep the laws from being written and or being enforced upon us that are tyrannical, that they don't drive laws down our throats. This is how we've created monarchies. Anyway, so as the framers went into this constitutional convention, they realized such I'll just say, such significant glaring problems with the Articles of Confederation that they wanted to make sure they framed a government that was different. When we look at the Articles of Confederation, who was the judiciary? They didn't have one. They had to basically, if they needed a judiciary, they'd have to call upon somebody to serve. And then they would have some kind of moot oversight. I mean, the judiciary was really non-existent in that magistrate that they created with Continental Congress. See, Continental Congress was the only body of governing at the top level. And it only proved that it was inefficient or incapable of doing the full functions of the magistrate itself. But they knew we did not want a king. They knew we could not have a king. So going into the convention, the Constitutional Convention of 1787, these men, you know, came in with these different designs and plans. Madison's plan was basically going to keep something very similar, that the legislative body, but he was looking to break it up. And it was Madison in his plan. He did devise the idea of distributing the magistrate into three separate branches. But his plan was to maintain apportionment based on population. And in other words, that apportionment would have been based upon our power, empowering more of the populated states within the congressional body. In other words, Congress was only going to be one body, would have been the representatives, and the states that had more people would have better representation. And this plan was rejected by Delaware. It was rejected by the small states, saying, look, we don't trust you big states. You're going to marginalize us. And basically what Madison's plan was that the states would become administrative agents for this federal government, for the general government that they were creating. And so that was another part of the real problem. They said, we don't want to have that much power in that government. So the New Jersey plan basically was kind of like an expansion of adding the three heads, but maintaining a Continental Congress the way they had it. In other words, it was really saying, we don't want to go too far beyond what we've already got. Then Roger Sherman came up with the Sherman Compromise, or the Connecticut Compromise, was the brilliance that was brought in creating a bicameral legislative body. And then they were able to have some really honest conversations regarding how to create this three-headed magistrate, or this three-headed body of government that had these three separate functions of a judiciary. The judiciary cannot create law. They can only determine whether the law as defined based on facts and evidence was violated or not. And they had jurisdiction only over those things arising under the Constitution. They couldn't assume jurisdiction. But, you know, there's never a point in time. And as a matter of fact, when you really, you know, if let's say you have a dispute, you can take your dispute to anybody. And 9 times out of 10, that person will say, well, you know, maybe the first thing they should think of is that they don't have any jurisdiction. I don't have any dog in this fight, but you're an impartial person. We want you to be the judge of this. Well, folks, you just don't do that. You don't willy-nilly go to somebody and say, will you be the judge? Especially if they don't have jurisdiction. Because you're surrendering your sovereignty to an entity that shouldn't really have say to determine. Because, you know, what would keep that person from saying, well, I think you're both wrong and you need to pay me. In other words, they aggrandize themselves over you. They do not have the jurisdiction to actually be that arbiter of the matter, the law and facts. So as they created this federal government, as they went into this constitution and gave us this model of government, a three-headed government, what they didn't have, what they didn't really understand, was that this government was to be the model that would actually trickle down in the forming of states and forming of this republic, that we had a three-tiered republic. Now, this is, I think, the this is the one thing that I think eludes most people, because they didn't put it in black and white that every state needed to reconfigure themselves. But the one thing that they did, and the one thing that was really standing out, was this thing in the Declaration of Independence that governments are instituted by, because this was a new concept. Prior to this nation being formed, governments were instituted by birthright. Governments were instituted maybe by some people, but it was never the people. Now, as a matter of fact, we even have cases where governments were instituted by God. And we could actually say in our constitutional republic, this government was instituted by God, by the divine hand of providence. And I can say that because all of the framers said that. Not directly, but by inspiration and guiding. And it was through the prayer of seeking, after Benjamin Franklin said, hey, excuse me, if can a sparrow fall from the sky without our Creator noticing? Then how can we as men erect a government without his help, without, you know, his acknowledgement in what we're doing? And so it was that was the precursor for Benjamin Franklin to tell the delegates in the Philadelphia Convention that they needed to pray before they met. And they did each day from that point forward. And in so doing, it changed the tone and it changed the spirit. And it allowed them to be far more susceptible to the promptings and the guidance of what they needed to do. Which is why, if you really look at what they did from that point until the early September, how they pounded out this Constitution and its intricacies, it's just amazing. Look how long Chile has been trying to pound out a constitution of the people. I mean, it's been going on for years. I don't even know if they're done yet. It's been so long. And so when we look at this constitution moving forward, had they inserted the line that all states needed to be reformed and instituted by the people, there's no doubt in my mind that the states would have rejected it, because the states already had a problem with giving, you know, a little bit more power to this federal government. They wanted, and they didn't want to share their power, especially the more big, powerful states, which is why those states actually fought, or I should say they vigorously debated the Constitution to try to prove that it's not ready for prime time, that they didn't think that it would have been a good thing for them to surrender their power to this federal government. That's why the anti-federalists made these wild assertions. But what's really the best part of what the anti-federalists did was they forced the federalists to actually define this constitution so that moving forward, the courts would actually have the clear terms and definitions of each of the clauses of the constitution. Now, the fact is that the judiciary has completely ignored the ratification debates, even though they are legally binding. They're the bedrock of the compact itself. When you understand contract law, stipulations that are clearly articulated to define what something means, that becomes legally binding within the compact itself. So as they started going forward in creating this republic after, as they've ratified this constitution, many states felt compelled to reform themselves. Now, they did not truly reform themselves from the ground up. What do I mean by that? I'm going back to the Declaration of Independence, that we the people institute our governments, and the governments that we institute are our county governments. We don't institute our state or the federal government. That would just be a nightmare. What we do is we create a constitution for our county, and then the counties would send delegates to create a constitution for our states. This is why I clearly point out the problems with moving forward without doing things properly based on this model that God gave us, or that the framers were inspired to create. Had we started actually creating constitutions at the county level, then the first states that would have been joined into the Union would have had a clause in the very beginning saying all powers not delegated to the state are reserved to the counties or the people respectively. Ah, now you begin to see that we actually at the federal level have a general government that only provides good services, not goods, but services in defending us and protecting us from foreign aggression, foreign trade, and those types of things, where they regulate and make sure their obligation is to make sure that we're not susceptible to hostile economic tactics. Their job is to protect our liberties and our sovereignty, not to sell us out, not to allow a cartel like OPEC to form. Anyway, when we formed the states were to be the same thing. They were to make sure, as a general government, that all the counties had equal protection, that they would ensure that they were safe and sovereign and maintain and regulate the trade among them, but not within them. That within each county, there is a concept of self-determination, that we the people, let's say the people over in this county over here want to have a self-determination, that they want to have a Republican form of government, but they want to have it more democratic in form. Well, as long as it still meets the standards where they recognize the sovereignty of the people and the sovereignty of that government that the people have created, then that's okay. And allows them, if they want to actually delegate powers to that county government, so that the county government can, dole out social welfare, to provide social education and health care and those types of things. If that's what they want to do, then it would be up to those people in that county. But all of the other counties would not be obligated to do the same thing. And as a matter of fact, there's no way the state can do it until you have a majority of the counties doing it. Ah, but you see, what happens is if you change and you move away from a Republican form, in other words, a body of republics, each county being a republic, each state being a republic, and our form of national government being a republic, then now you can see how the protections and the separations of powers at the county level become so integral. So when we come back, we'll take it from there and we'll start moving forward, and then we can really start talking about, why we're in this pickle, or we'll get to that. We'll get to that, because what we want to actually examine is what happened right out the gate. So we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so, you know, it's just easy to sit here and make it sound good, but actually, when we look at how the, because they knew that there was a future in this new republic that they created. Every state along that eastern seaboard, almost all of them, had an expansion of territories. And as a matter of fact, some of these territories were already becoming ready to become states, which is why we see that Vermont was created. And then we see that Kentucky was created, then Tennessee. And so as these states were created, they were created and they were brought into the Union, not by the federal government, but by the people of the states. In other words, the states kind of self-determine themselves. But how did they do that? Well, so at this point in time, people didn't see how government could become so involved in their lives. And let me ask you this, because Thomas Jefferson really articulated this the best. Who should be able to make the decisions that affect you directly in your life? Who is best to make that decision? Is it the person who's governing you from thousands of miles away? Or maybe it's the person that's governing you from a couple hundred miles away? Or maybe... Think about it. It may be those people governing you that are just a few miles away in the county seat. So when we look at who we really want to regulate and who we can hold accountable the easiest, the closer you get to home, the better it is, which is why Jefferson articulated this concept of this design. He wasn't even at the Constitutional Convention, but he had the brilliance of understanding how this was such a beautiful system that Jefferson's tone had changed completely. His comment that the roots of the tree of liberty needs to be refreshed with the blood of a revolution every 20 years, that was prior to the Constitutional Convention, prior to this Constitution. Now, when you look at his tone and how it changed, as we received this, he was the one that basically came out. And as a matter of fact, I believe the terms by him or Madison, because I believe I cited it just recently, where they used the terms centripetal and centrifugal. And so when we really look at this concept, I think it was Madison that actually used the terms. But when we looked at this concept that Jefferson basically stated, he says that the political energy, there's two types of political energies in government, period. There's only one nation in the world that allows the energy, the political energy, to go from the center out to the people. In other words, the repository of the majority of energy is with the people, close to the people. all other governments centralizes the power. They possess all of the powers and all of the decisions in a central form. And that's the design of communism. That's the design of a monarchy. That's the design of all of these other forms of government. Our government was distributive. We were empowered to allow our local governments to do whatever we wanted them to do. Now, back in those days, they couldn't imagine, like I was saying, they couldn't imagine government determining, you know, how much water you were going to use to flush or what kind of light bulbs you were going to use to illuminate your home. They couldn't imagine that government would get into your knickers on every little aspect of your life, that if you removed this tag, you were subject to penalty on a pillow or a mattress by law. So my point is that those things that we're dealing with, those all came from a centralized form of governing. They didn't come from we the people. We the people wouldn't have put up with that kind of nonsense. We the people wouldn't have allowed them to actually give us, especially not as a central body. I mean, it's one thing to watch a city, because if you really look at this model, the model would be that the cities, the large population centers that wanted to regulate themselves to the nth degree, all of the people that would be living in the county surrounding that city would go, well, you know, that's not working. And they would have all of the empirical data over time to prove that what they're doing in regulating and giving themselves more and more power and delegating more power to that local government is just the wrong thing to do. And that they have to undo that to allow the people, but you have to have some levels of constraint, but you have to allow the people to be able to make the best decisions for themselves, how they're going to feed themselves. Now, in a city, you may get to a point where you just can't have a pig farm in, you know, on this little plot of property or in your apartment. As much as you love to have bacon and ham and pig products, you just can't let them, you know, stay in a room in this apartment that you have, as it creates a health problem. In other words, what you are doing is creating a problem. But bottom line, they can't regulate away. I mean, it's a huge mistake to allow government to create a flat rule of saying nobody can grow or have any livestock. Nobody can grow their own food. That is a fundamental right. It's an inalienable right that we all have a right to be able to provide for ourselves. However, your rights end when they start affecting other people. These are fundamental rules, or these are fundamental laws that we all have learned throughout our lives, that your rights begin with you and they end where they affect someone else. So now, speech is one of those things that is absolutely inalienable. It doesn't matter if you hurt somebody's feelings. This is America. You have a right to have your feelings hurt. And hopefully we learn to be less sensitive and just realize that that person that, you know, is a foul-mouthed person is just a foul-mouthed, rude, crude, and uneducated person. And we move on. They're ignorant, whatever. But my point is as we started creating counties, we never did what we should have done. We should have created constitutions and delegated to our county government. And actually, in creating our county government, we should have followed the three-headed model of the magistrate. See, this is where it takes me back to the doctrine of magistrates. Somehow people think that your sheriff is the magistrate. Whoever thinks that is absolutely wrong. We are a representative government. The sheriff can't make law. Who makes law at our local level? It is to be our legislators. That's typically county commissioners. Now, in some states, and I've just come to find out, New York is one of those states that is really actually has incorporated the brilliant design of the federal layout, or I should say what we received under the Constitution. They actually have an executive in working with folks in Orange County within New York. We've realized that there's an executive at the county level. They have legislators and they have a judiciary. They have the three heads of government. Every county should have that. Every county has a judge. Every county usually has a board of supervisors or they have commissioners. But nobody has created an executive. And you need an executive because the executive's responsibility is to try to work out trade agreements to help bring more business into your county, to help develop the county, to help, you know, creating trade agreements and so forth. I mean, you have a lot of mud and straw. You can make the bricks to build those buildings in the city. What have you? There are ways and things and means where you can actually allow your government to help your county flourish. But instead, if you allow bureaucrats at the state level, then the bureaucrats can actually regulate you down to a nub. And that's what we're seeing as we look at the bureaucrats from D.C. through our states into your counties, regulating us to a nub. So what do we do? Let me get back to bringing states into the union. As we looked at the first few states coming into the union, they were all brought in the same way. The counties sent delegates to create a constitution. When we went through the resolutions of 98 by Kentucky and Virginia, Madison went out of his way to point out that the body that created that constitution, that is the party or parties to the Constitution. So who created your state constitution? Every state in the Union, as they redesigned their constitutions, they sent delegates. Every state that joined the Union from the very beginning, even till, I don't know about Alaska and Hawaii, but I do know that all states beforehand actually had a constitutional convention where the counties sent delegates. So in looking and examining the federal constitution, who are the parties to the federal constitution? The states are. The state legislatures are, because that is the body sovereign of that government. Who's the body sovereign of our county government? It is our legislators, because we're a Republican form of government. The body sovereign are our representatives, those who are determining whether we're going to have laws and whether we're not going to have those laws. And if we're not happy with what they're doing and creating laws, we replace them to undo what they have done. That's the beauty of a Republican system. A Republican system is also one founded on the law. You cannot institute laws that actually violate the supreme law, i.e. the Constitution, i.e. the state constitution. When you delegate very specific powers to that state government, then what we're doing is we're giving them these very specific powers of regulating trade amongst the states. Now we're talking about at your state level. So as we looked at all of these states coming into the union, every single one of them created constitutions, which means that the counties are the parties to that, even though they didn't even say it in the compact itself. It is still the fundamental tenet, and it is the nature of compacts that those parties to it, because the U.S. Constitution doesn't say that the states are the parties to it, but it does say that it needed to be ratified by the states. Now, however the states decided to ratify it is even a separate issue itself. Those who created that Constitution, i.e. the counties, and the sovereigns of the county. And see, the other thing I just want to help you understand is that when we look at sovereignty and we look at perpetual entities, it is the divine wisdom that sovereignty is not actually maintained and transferred like an estate. When we create a governing body like a county, state, and federal, it becomes a perpetual entity, and it becomes this changing entity in terms of its construction or makeup, the people that are in it. But the laws themselves stay the same. How we have, you know, basically empowered that government, how we've instituted, that's the key word out of the Declaration of Independence, how we instituted that government is to be the same, and only we who institute have the power to change that. Does Germany have the power to change our U.S. Constitution? No. Had we actually included that, that would have been, I'll just say, asinine. It's the same thing with our state constitutions. The problem is that we made big mistakes at our state constitution because we allowed a democracy, a mob rule. And the problem is that the federal government, those people that were in the federal government in Congress at the time, never recognized that that failed to hit the muster on a Republican form of government. Every state that uses a democracy in its amendment process, which I've gone through this, and I've got a breakdown of how every state amends their constitution. And there's not one state. I think New Hampshire is probably the closest, but it's 2/3 of the people does not recognize the sovereignty of the counties. There's not one state in the union that recognizes the sovereignty of your counties. Why? If we, the people, institute government, the most important and the most precious government to us is our local government. We need, if we're going to take our states back, we need to actually get county commissioners that really empower we, the people, our county supervisors, our parish supervisors, whatever they're called in Louisiana. We need to appoint those who are going to empower the people to take that county back, to say, you are not going to govern us without us delegating power to you. And this becomes the beginning of waking up counties so that counties can actually start holding states accountable. The real tragedy that we're really facing is the majority of the things that the state and county are doing to you folks is coming from the federal government. And you'll notice that most state constitutions have never been modified to allow the federal government to come in with tyrannical powers. I'll give you a good case in point. The Department of Transportation. We clearly have proven that the federal government has no authority to create any laws regarding the transportation of goods. They have no authority whatsoever to improve highways and waterways. We have three presidents that vetoed congressional attempts of doing that. If the federal government is to possess that role, responsibility, and power, we must amend the Constitution. Therefore, the federal government doesn't have that authority. So when they basically told your state to do this, then your state allowed the federal government to inject tyranny at the state level. Ah, because it came with money. Ah, but that money is fraudulent. They didn't have the authority to print that money to spend on those things. And if you can start recognizing how this actually snowballs down this huge, it creates this huge mess in creating this Leviathan. Because if you look at all the roles, responsibilities, and powers that they are exercising that are unconstitutional, from the Department of Transportation, housing, health and human services, labor, all of these things, energy, all of these, education, the money that they're spending on these unconstitutional things, that monster we call the national debt is fraudulent. Every nation that has purchased our debt knows, they know that our government did not have the authority to take that money and to spend it. In other words, these leaders of these other nations are equally culpable in trying to undermine and destroy America by waging economic warfare against us. And they even got our own federal government to exercise economic warfare against us. So getting back to the counties, it is critical that we actually start using the Constitution in holding people accountable. So what has happened is I kind of jumped from this concept of the early days in forming states to where counties created every state in the union, to now we have all of these roles, responsibilities, powers, and properties that are being possessed and exercised by the federal government unconstitutionally are afflicting this debt and damage upon us. Believing that everything is true, there's a lot of really dangerous organizations out there that want you to believe that this is all legitimate. I'm here to tell you, when Christ comes, all of this debt's gone, and the needs of the people will be met, and everybody will be moved towards self-sufficiency. In other words, the fact that the gaming of systems of where you're entitled to get money and you can use the system and take from those who have, that's going to end. But to get there is going to be something different outside of our control. But to take back this country, we have all the control over, folks. So let me just connect the dots. As we look at the framework of the Constitution, we understand that the Constitution delegates very specific roles, responsibilities, powers, and even property to the federal government. Those things not delegated are reserved to the states or to the people. Therefore, as we look at the framework and the public servants that are being admitted into our governing body, there's this one beautiful thing that really jumped out of the ratification debates that actually changed the hearts of anti-federalists to say, this is a good system. This oath of office is incredible. James Monroe, who was an anti-federalist, in many cases spoke out, or made hyperbole or made some comments that were, not necessarily accurate, like the Electoral College and some of these other things. He actually had favor towards the oath of office. Now we actually have a legally binding oath over these people. Right there in Article 6, all public servants are to take an oath and or affirmation to support this Constitution. And so they do. And so every state in the union and every public servant that operates in that state, they all are under an oath of office. And then as the Constitution moved forward with the Bill of Rights, we were given within the First Amendment the right of petition. So the right of petition is giving you, the citizen, the ability to hold these public servants accountable to this very Constitution. The problem is, when government started reaching into its pockets, we the people didn't realize that we should be actually holding them accountable. And there was no movement to do that because, I guess, the machinations or there was a lot. I'll tell you what. There was a lot of deception going on because those people at the state were getting federal dollars that was making their lives better. And so they allowed, and this is what we see today. This is where we see corruption today. Folks, you have to understand the corruption is the rust, the rot, and the cancer of this nation. It's the downfall of every nation. And corruption is literally pulled us to this brink. We have to turn our backs on corruption. We have to turn our backs on the entitlement state. We have to pull up our britches and say, we're going to have to get through this. We actually have to man up, cowboy up, woman up, whatever, up, and take it as it comes. We have to actually go through that austerity. There is no bubble wrap that's going to protect us. But I am telling you that the tonic is far worse. The cure, this tonic that gives us the cure, is far worse than the outcome if we do nothing. Because being fully subjugated and being told and losing liberty is unacceptable. And the people of this nation will rue the day if we don't actually start standing up. But we've been given everything. That's why I'm pointing to this legal oath of office and the right of petition. The right of petition is the same thing. It's tantamount to you balling up your fist in public and plowing that fist right between the eyes to every single public servant for their oath of office, for violating their oath. But it's metaphorically plowing them between the eyes, because with a petition, you actually spell out exactly how they have violated their oath and how they are susceptible to being banished. Oh, but how are they susceptible to being banished? That is the third dot. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. After the Civil War, only God knew that there was no teeth in the law. There was this honor among thieves that actually became evident, that there was no way the thieves were going to hold themselves accountable, that the days of honor and integrity had washed away as the whole soul of our society has become corrupt. So the 13th or the 14th Amendment, after the Civil War, that 14th Amendment became the crowning jewel. It became the closing of the circle, because it created the law that if you, while under oath, violate your oath or fail to support, which is the same thing, fail to support this Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, then you are no longer eligible to be a public servant. You have perjured yourself while standing in office and must be removed from office. And folks, we have to demand that we hold our public servants accountable, that they allow us, that they allow that law to be enforced, because they are the obstinates. They're obviating, they're removing our ability to hold them accountable. They refuse to hold themselves accountable. So this is why we actually have to go down this path of getting public servants to demand to be held accountable. And from there, we'll talk about this tomorrow, of what and how to do this, and how First Amendment petitions are the integral part of all of this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.